Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
This week, Halloween.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free, and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio.
Hello, and welcome to Culture Cube. I'm your host, Sarah Bowden. This week, the grotesque, the gory, the haunted. It's the spookiest time of the year. In its fourth year of scaring, the Soap Factory's haunted basement has become a Twin Cities must-see. Reporter Ron Miller ventured into the darkness to retrieve this tale.
Ah, the Halloween memories. Cheap plasticky costumes, trick-or-treating, pumpkins, mildly scary haunted houses to walk through, some cleared-out municipal building. One of those, I've come to suck your blood, the blood, kind of scares. Whatever happened to the good old days of scaring the living daylights out of people on Halloween? Welcome to the Minneapolis-based Soap Factory with their fourth annual Haunted Basement. The Soap Factory is a nonprofit art gallery located a couple blocks off St. Anthony, Maine in Minneapolis. It's been there for nearly 30 years, just down the street from the A-Mill at 518 2nd Street. And yes, it is actually an old soap factory building. 5 years ago, Chris Pennington got an idea to stage a haunted house out of the empty and very spooky basement as a fundraiser for the gallery upstairs. But the first year out was a bust. The place wasn't up to code. But the basement itself was a spooky winner. So the next year they got things right and the rest is history. Nearly 10,000 people will go through the haunted basement this year. 14 of the 22 days it's been open, it's been sold out, including Halloween. It's adult only, 18 plus. You have to sign a waiver. It's that scary.
IDs will be checked at the door. No alcohol, no touching any of the exhibits or performers. You must have appropriate clothing to navigate through challenging environments. No high heels or flip-flops. You'll be required to sign the waiver before entering the haunted basement.
One of the leads in the haunted basement project is Tom Loftus.
It's really an old factory basement building, and because of that, it's part of the reason why it's so authentic. People have talked about ours as being the most authentic of the haunted houses and haunted basements and those types of things around the cities. And the fact of the matter is lots of people spend a lot of money making their things look creepy and gross and dingy and dirty, and we get a little bit of that given to us. And we also know that from just having people go down there. When I went down there 5 years ago with Chris, he showed me it with just a flashlight, and it looked terrifying. I mean, it was you kind of like turn around and you look for things that aren't there.
Oh my God, you lied!
This is a different kind of scare than most. It's designed by artists that pitched their ideas back in April. The best are chosen and start building in June, finishing up by October. They also have a theme.
Well, at the beginning, it was distortion. And I think that we've moved from that to more of a narrative. The basement being sort of a what if everything went wrong above ground. And this is sort of our idea of what maybe like a ghoul, like not a ghoulish, I should say, what the future could look like and what it might look like if things go bad above ground and the crazy things that people might do, people, you know, getting into all sorts of crazy stuff without getting into it.
What actually takes place in the basement is a closely guarded secret. Tom and the others were tight-lipped about what happens down below, and having been through myself the first night it was open, what I will tell you about my experience is that they'll prey on your senses and feed on the fear from deep within your soul.
We kind of hit all the senses. That's about as much as I'd want to say. It's something that you have to experience. We try to catch people off guard and try to build up anticipation, but yeah, we try to hit all the senses and keep people guessing. I think that's always worked for us, is kept everything that's going down in the basement very secretive and let people see it for themselves.
Every few minutes, minders upstairs send people through in groups of six, down a long set of stairs and into utter and sheer terror. If people can't handle it, they can say a safe word and be whisked away to safety. Last year, over 200 people called Uncle. People that made it could stop for a moment and rest before leaving, on a long, decrepit couch in a room that has the feel of an employee lounge in a 1960s factory, just before stepping out to the street to leave into the inky black of night. A Minnesota state flag stands limp on a pole in the corner. Red stuffed chairs are empty at the end of the room, as if the occupants just stepped out of the meeting. Faded lime green paint, blocked glass windows, and a 1945 Great Northern Railway calendar complete the image of a shop lounge from years gone by. And here is where I met some of the survivors.
It was absolutely terrifying.
Have you been to other haunted houses before?
Yes, I have.
Nothing like this?
Nothing like this. This was ridiculously terrifying.
Did you scream?
I screamed a lot. I think I'm going to lose my voice tomorrow.
The Soap Factory's haunted basement runs through October 31st, Halloween. For Culture Q, I'm Ron Miller.
If you weren't able to buy tickets to the Soap Factory's haunted basement before they sold out, maybe you want to check out some real hauntings instead. Eric Dolsky and Mark Sheely count down the top seven most haunted places in Minnesota.
I'm in studio with fellow reporter Mark Sheely. What's our top seven for this week, Mark?
Our top seven for this week is the top seven haunted places in Minnesota.
Okay, so number seven.
Number seven is a golf course in Montgomery, Minnesota. Two people are buried on the first hole of the golf course, one of them being an old farmer who the staff claims haunts the golf course after closing.
That must be a pretty terrible golf game for everyone. I wonder how they stay in business. Number six.
Number six is Glensheen Mansion in Duluth, where Elizabeth Cogden and her nurse were murdered by the husband of her adopted daughter.
I guess it happens. Sometimes people get murdered. Okay, number five.
Number five is First Avenue in the case of the lady in the green jacket. She hung herself in one of the stalls of the women's bathroom and now appears to anybody unfortunate enough to use it.
That kind of makes me glad that I'm a male whenever I go to First Avenue.
Yeah, it's something we don't have to worry about.
Yeah. Okay, so number four.
Number four is Four Paws Restaurant in St. Paul. Before it was a restaurant, it was a mansion owned by Joseph Fourpaw, who entered into an affair with one of the maids, Molly. His wife found out, and being distraught and supposedly pregnant with Joseph's child, she hung herself. Years later, Joseph Fourpaw also hung himself, and now it's said that the two haunt the building, with Joseph roaming the dining room and Molly supposedly appearing in a photo of a wedding reception held at the restaurant.
Number three.
Number three is the Le Sueur County Historical Society Museum. The building used to be a schoolhouse. It was turned into a museum. And now it's supposedly haunted by elements of each. There's said to be a school teacher dubbed Willie by paranormal investigators who will rearrange items in the museum. And there's a story of a girl who was supposedly locked into a bathroom for a short period of time by one of the spirits of the children.
That must have been a pretty either awesome or terrible experience to be, like, locked in a bathroom stall by ghosts. We just went to number three. Number two.
Number two is the Ramsey County Courthouse, haunted by the ghost of the unfortunately named William Williams. Williams was actually the last man to be executed in the state of Minnesota after suffering from a botched hanging. The guards overestimated the amount of rope needed. Williams hit the floor, actually had to be hoisted up, and it ended up taking 14 and a half minutes for him before he was pronounced dead.
That sounds horribly painful and also slightly depressing.
Sounds like enough to make him want to haunt the building.
Yeah, I'd haunt anyone who tried to strangle me, I think. So that's number two. We're down to the number one most haunted place in Minnesota.
The number one most haunted place in Minnesota is Heffern Hall at St. Mary's University in Winona. There were two separate incidents that happened here. One was the attempted murder of a bishop by a priest back in 1915. Years later, in 1931, Reverend Lynch was discovered dead, having been electrocuted by his lamp. And so years later, when the building was turned into a dorm for seminarians, reports started showing up of students hearing a cane tapping along the wall, and even more fantastic accounts of one student apparently punching the ghost of Father Lynch and breaking his hand in the process.
That must be like a great story to tell your children. I once punched a ghost and broke my hand.
Exactly.
This has been the top 7 most haunted places in Minnesota.
How old is too old to trick or treat? Tamara Marcus has the answer.
Halloween has always been my favorite holiday. Even at the age of 17, I didn't hesitate for a moment. I knew I would be out come trick-or-treating time. A friend and I threw on some fishnet armbands and a pair of tangled wigs, did our makeup, and decided we'd be rock stars for a night. Partway through our Halloween expedition, we stumbled upon a house that by all accounts seemed home to a charming elderly woman who would shower us with the fruits of Halloween. We knocked, and the door creaked open. In front of us stood a barely older than middle-aged woman wearing a lumpy black sweater with felt pumpkins covering the front. She looked as though she'd opened her door to a bag of flaming poop. Seeing her less than cheerful countenance, my friend and I greeted her with, "Trick or treat!" She continued to look us up and down, noticing the sparkly boa draped around me and the words "Rockstar" printed on my friend's forehead in black permanent marker. "Shouldn't you guys be at a party somewhere getting drunk?" she asked us. Here I was, at 17, trying to have a perfectly innocent Halloween, and I was being berated for not being plastered at some crazy party. "Excuse me for wanting to dress up, get candy, and be a little kid again. Let me just go change into my party clothes, get smashed, and drive around the streets Halloween night playing How Many Hannah Montanas Can You Hit? With my friends." Don't buy into the societal conventions of Halloween being only for hyperactive kids with light-up shoes and 8 o'clock bedtimes. Grab that tattered pillowcase, don those dingy white sheets, and celebrate Halloween the right way. Find him.
One of the best parts of Halloween is the decorations. So, producer Todd Karate asks, what is the scariest Halloween decoration you have ever seen?
One of my roommates had this fake hand that he bought for a zombie pub crawl last year and left it, sticking out from underneath this cabinet. And it was really bloody and kind of, chewed up. And, that was by far the scariest thing, because it was, right around this corner, so you couldn't see it until you're, peeking around, and it was, right in your face.
Somebody had, a papier-mâché Michael Jackson out in front of their yard, so that was pretty scary.
Oh, this one's easy. When I was younger, those skeletons that came down from, trick-or-treat doors, those were always terrifying.
The Freddy versus Jason, you know, the hockey mask thing, that always creeps me out with the blood and stuff all over it. And yeah,
the hand that pops out of the candy dish.
Clowns, a yard full of clowns. It was pretty traumatizing.
They'll have somebody that looks like a dummy in their front yard, hanging or in a pile of leaves or something, but then they'll actually be a real person and they'll just scare the crap out of people.
Scariest one was the one without anything. I mean, you know, it should be Halloween, but houses or people without doing anything, that's the scariest, I think, you know. It's like the house that you don't know if you should get in or if you should trick or treat, or like the ones that you have no idea.
Well, I haven't seen much, but I am assuming that the carved pumpkin with the candles inside them, lighting them, glowing them, and seeing them in the dark would be the most scariest thing that I'm ever going to see relevant to Halloween, in the dark especially.
What is the scariest Halloween decoration you have ever experienced?
I went trick-or-treating once, and
We went up to a house with, like, wheat or whatever and a little decoration, and all of a sudden some guy popped out from behind it in a mask and a costume, and it freaked me out to no end. It was horrible.
In the last segment, one guy said that what really scared him was people who didn't answer the door. Well, it so happens that Culture Q's Yi Chun Li grew up in a family who ignored trick-or-treaters come October 31st.
My family moved from Taiwan to the U.S. about 8 years ago, so we don't have a tradition of celebrating Halloween. We think it's troublesome to open the door every 5 minutes, and we think it's weird to talk to the children and their parents. We would probably run out of ideas and phrases to praise the children and their costumes. So, every year, to avoid trick-or-treaters, we stay out of the house or we pretend we're not home. We eat dinner before kids start trick-or-treating. Then, we put a bowl of candies by our front door, close the blinds and curtains, and shut the lights off. We'll do stuff at the back of our house where people can't see from the street. If someone rings the bell, we'll just ignore it.
Welcome back to Culture Q. I'm Sarah Bowden, and right now I'm in studio with spoken word artist Guante.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
You're going to perform a poem for us today called Love in the Time of Zombies.
Yeah, a seasonally appropriate piece.
Definitely. You have a YouTube video of you performing this, and it seems that you're talking into a video camera. It's kind of like you're leaving a last will and testament, and then you can hear presumably zombies banging on the doors and trying to like break in. Mm-hmm. What made you want to present the poem in that way?
It's kind of mind-boggling to me that there aren't more spoken word, quote-unquote, music videos, because, like, most of the stuff on YouTube is live performance, which is, you know, spoken word is very much an audience-based art form, so it makes sense that there are people performing and people clapping and whatever, whatever, but it's also, I think, again, just in terms of, like, the possibilities are so endless with doing kind of short films like that. And, I mean, this was something me and my friend just kind of threw together. We shot it in, like, one take, and it happened to work out. We didn't need any special effects or any kind of budget. It just worked. And I really want to do more stuff like that. I think more poets should try that.
Well, I really liked it. Okay, so you want to perform the poem?
Sure. They fell upon us softly, like leaves rustling around landmines, a blade buried in wet soil, starving for the essence of our love, they enveloped us. First, a few haunted homes on the outskirts of town, then into the proud city herself, then spreading like a spilled can of burgundy paint across the map, swallowing. Appetites attached to talons, blue-white fangs in children's mouths, wine always escapes its cup one way or another. We should have seen it coming. But when they appeared, pale and shrieking on the horizon, the might of 5,000 years of cups and dishes and goblets shattered and the spill drowned every dream ever dreamt. But you, I found you treading water, regardless, as invincible as canned food in 2x4s. I found you exploding, brimstone on your lips, tattooed with the fury as warm as the sun used to be. I found you beautiful, shaved head, Kevlar, bare hands. You cut them down, you broke them. You found knives between your knuckles and war clubs inside your leg bones. I still remember how the ghost of a smile flickered across your eyes when you leaned in close to me and whispered, "Take the shotgun. See, I want the fireman's axe. I want to feel it. I want to feel them beneath it." And I knew then that I wanted to be with you forever. Knew that we were to share an ancient love, a love bonded with flint and bone, that our skulls now carried within them a shining new darkness, twin oblivions monogrammed his and hers, our first date. Fireballing through hordes of the undead, dull silver eyes and ragged hands reaching, screams bisected, every gunshot a climax, every swing of that axe a bedroom's liquid whisper. In the blackness, I smelled your humanity and aimed in the opposite direction. Love, warm and grasping, splashed against the walls, love splashed onto our bodies, love splashing inside of us defiantly. And I found you in the smoking chaos, our shoulder blades kissed. Now there may come a day when the sun bursts from the spider's belly to smile upon this world again. There may come a day when love can be represented by poetry and romantic comedies and candlelight dinners again. When it may be held soft and round in the palm of a child's hand. But it's not on us to build that world. It's not even on us to survive this one. Ours is not a love song sprouted from redemption, hope, or even longing. But it is a love song. Sing it under your breath. Sharpen it every morning. If you should fall, I swear I'll come for you. Two barrels erupting as one, an aluminum baseball bat strapped to my back, a pocket full of hand grenades. Singing, pins already pulled.
If you want more Guante, he has an apocalyptic concept album called An Unwelcome Guest, and he's performing at Hell's Kitchen Halloween Show this Saturday.
Puppets, much like clowns, can give you the heebie-jeebies. Those frozen expressions, eyes that never focus, felt hands, ugh. Mark Sheely explores the Twin Cities puppetry scene and one show in particular that's after your soul.
You are under my spell. You are bending to my will. Your eyes are getting heavy. Well, no. Not your eyes, of course. Your eyelids. Your eyelids are getting heavy.
The spooky voice you're hearing is that of Count Lashak, a teal-blue vampire who plays the head of the fictitious Transylvania Television. Along with Lashak, the station is run with the help of Furry J. Ackermonster, an Orange Yeti, Rat Fink, a bulgy-eyed beatnik rodent, and Dwayne Frankenstein, who is, well, Frankenstein. Although the sets span an entire Transylvanian castle, the entire series is shot in just one 25-by-35-foot studio space, right here in Minneapolis.
I thought I was going to have a really cool, red sports car for my midlife crisis, but no, I ended up with a studio space full of puppets.
I like ponies.
Yeah, I can see that.
They taste like chicken.
I don't know where I went wrong, but it seems to be working out okay.
This is Gordon Smooter, one of the two creators of Transylvania Television, along with Michael Hegel. Smooter both plays and voices multiple puppets for the series. And though these puppets look like they would fit right in on one of Jim Henson's Muppets productions, Transylvania Television really isn't for kids, as a scene with Furry and Dwayne illustrates.
Okay, Dwayne, enough already. What is it you want me to see? Holy crap!
I have the heart of a 6-year-old girl.
No kidding.
I found it in the cellar.
Started back in 2007, after Smooter and Hegel had worked together on another project, Transylvania Television went from a half-hour TV pilot to 3 seasons on the web, to an hour-long Halloween special that aired just last week on the Twin Cities CW channel.
I was sitting in a meeting, and Michael said, "You know what? Shooting an hour-long show isn't really that much harder than shooting a half-an-hour show," and I nearly choked on my own tongue.
Working in puppetry goes beyond traditional performance art. Instead of simply acting the role of another character, the puppeteer both builds and inhabits an entirely new character, in a way that can produce some unexpected results.
There are times when I'm performing that I'm watching the monitor and I see my puppet do things that I'm just not consciously thinking about. And then there are times when I go back and I look at the footage and go, I don't remember doing that.
According to Lauren Nemi, executive director of In the Heart of the Beast Puppet and Mask Theater, this is actually something quite common among experienced puppeteers.
As you begin to empty yourself into performance, you know, it's very easy to forget that it's you controlling it. What you're looking at is the relationship of yourself in kind of a physical and spiritual, verbal dialogue.
Nemi also believes that the origins of puppetry are rooted in religion.
The line from that experience of making the divine present for a people is directly aligned through and with puppetry. And let me tell you, when you are in a room with a shaman who is wearing a sacred mask and performing a dance to retrieve a soul, we are so far away from children's entertainment, it is instantly recognizable.
Back at the studio for Transylvania Television, amidst the castle wall set pieces, a night sky backdrop, there's one last thing I noticed that I have to ask Gordon Smooter about.
That particular clock came from the V-Corp workshop, which got it from the Little Shop of Horrors production workshop, the one directed by Frank Oz, mm-hmm. the movie. Who they got it from the original Muppet workshop. So it's been handed down and handed down and handed down. The second hand works, but the rest of it stopped working. But we keep it on hand because it's a token. And, you know, it just reminds us that, you know, time isn't really running out.
For Culture Q, I'm Mark Sheely.
Halloween is notorious not only for the surreal and scary, but also pranks. The Shankill Butchers. Alana Ostrin recalls one scam she ran throughout high school.
Heinous crimes are sometimes committed in Halloween, and I was never one to be left out. My friends and I orchestrated a particularly devious success by reinventing ourselves as a youth group that collected goods for children in need. For every year of high school, we'd quickly go to work on the day after Halloween. We'd head to different neighborhoods and pose as members of this false charity group, and we'd ask for leftover candy to be donated. Most bored housewives were happy to oblige us. Little did they know that the candy they so readily handed over was going to a group of high school students who pulled off this mission yearly. Senior year presented a dilemma, though. Should the mission be passed down to a younger group of con artists? Eventually, a collective decision was made against the move. Our legend would live on and go with us to the grave.
As the performer of one of Halloween's most classic songs, Screamin' Jay Hawkins has earned his place as one of the most terrifying voices in the blues. Mick takes a look and listen into the colorful life of this master of macabre.
While his legacy in the minds of many may be that of a one-hit novelty performer, Jaylissie Hawkins managed to make an undeniable stamp on the history of rock and roll. His wild, guttural voice and outlandish stage presence set the standard for showmanship in a new era of performers, and his trademark howl still sends shivers down the spines of listeners to this day. What better performer to honor on Halloween than the master of voodoo horror himself, Screamin' Jay Hawkins? Born in Ohio in 1929 and raised in Cleveland, Hawkins originally studied classical piano and harbored dreams of becoming an opera singer in the vein of Paul Robeson. When he failed to break through into the overwhelmingly white world of opera, Jaylissie fell back into a career as a blues singer. Although his powerful voice and flair for the grandiose and theatrical would still be present in his music.
I met a big woman with eyes of fury.
Hawkins would eventually join the Air Force to serve as an entertainer in the Pacific Theater of World War II, although he claims to have been captured and tortured as a prisoner of war. In one of his famously macabre tales, Screamin' Jay claims to have defeated his chief torturer by taping a hand grenade to their mouth and pulling the pin.
She put the whammy! She threw the whammy!
After a brief and successful stint as a middleweight prize fighter, Hawkins hung up his gloves and returned to music, releasing a chilling swamp blues entitled She Put the Whammy on Me. With the single's minor success and a growing reputation as an unmatched live performer, Screamin' Jay persuaded Columbia to release his most famous song, the legendary I Put a Spell on You.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
Originally intended to be recorded as a classy ballad, the old demon alcohol cast its own black magic over the studio session, with nearly every musician intoxicated past the point of sanity. Screamin' Jay grunted and howled his way through a mostly ad-lib performance like a man possessed, which may have not been that far from the truth. He would have to relearn the entirety of his terrifying vocal the next day, since he was blackout drunk during its recording. The song became a catalyst for a new era in Screamin' Jay's live performance, as the singer began to wear outlandish leopard skin suits, bone necklaces, and include props like rubber snakes and a skull staff that he nicknamed Henry. DJ Alan Freed famously offered Hawkins $300 to emerge from a coffin on stage, and the stunt would go on to become a regular feature of Screamin' Jay's shows. Although he would never match the success of I Put a Spell on You, Hawkins would continue to be a treasured entertainer and make music until his death in February of 2000. At 70 years of age, the old devil was reportedly survived by as many as 75 children. This is Zach McCormick for Culture Q. Cause my demon let him go all around through the world till he understand his pain. Somebody help him get his demon home again. He did a...
Well, that's our show. Today you heard stories from Ron Miller, Eric Dulski, Mark Sheely, Tamara Marcus, Todd Karate, Yi-Chin Lee, Alana Ostrin, and Zach McCormick. Our producers are Christetta Borini, Eric Dulski, and Zach McCormick. Sarah Lemanchek is the Arts and Culture Coach at Radio K. A special thanks to Guante, I'm Sarah Bowden, and until next week, this is Culture Q.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.